Mark chapter 1. We have been not in Mark for the past few weeks as we did some sermons over the Holy Week and Resurrection Sunday. But today we're back in Mark. Our focus for today will be verses 40 through 45. But since it's been a few weeks, we will begin reading in verse 21 to make sure we are back in the context of our story and know what's going on. In our reading, it will remind us that we've been introduced to Jesus' astonishing authority. We're going to hear about how astonishing his teaching was, how astonishing it was that he cast out demons and they listened to him, and how astonishing it was that by his touch and by his word, many were healed of fevers and other illnesses. And then we've heard that Jesus has done these things, and today, in verses 40 through 45, we're going to see a particular episode of him cleansing a leper. That's primarily what will be, it's five, six verses, Ella can correct me later, on cleansing a leper, the ask, the healing, and what happens next. As we break it down, I want to consider three things with you. Really simple. You're unclean. The only cleanser in Jesus' charge and our response. You are unclean. Jesus is a cleanser. And Jesus charges, and then we respond. Those are the things we'll be seeing. I am reading from a different translation this morning. I'm reading from the NIV, which is different for me, so it might be different for you to hear. But this is Mark chapter 1, starting in verse 21. They, speaking of Jesus and his disciples, went to Capernaum. And when the Sabbath came, Jesus went into the synagogue and began to teach. The people were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as one of the teachers of the law. Just then, a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an impure spirit cried out, "What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." "Be quiet," Jesus said sternly. "Come out of him." The impure spirit shook the man violently and came out of him with a shriek. The people were all so amazed that they asked one another, "What is this? A new teaching and with authority. He even gives orders to impure spirits and they obey him." News about him spread quickly over the whole region of Galilee. As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they immediately told Jesus about her. So he went to her and took her hand and helped her up. The fever had left her, and she began to wait on them. That evening, after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and the demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. This is our text for today. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus was indignant. He reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said. "Be clean." Immediately, the leprosy left him, and he was cleansed. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning. "See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest, and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them." Instead, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in lonely places. Yet the people still came to him from everywhere. Father, would you help me this morning? You know my weakness. You know our weakness. So would you help me to speak? Would you help me by your Spirit to speak what needs to be said? And would you apply these truths to our hearts, to keep them in our minds, and to help us to rejoice at the truths and respond accordingly? Lord, would you please help us in the name of your Son? Amen. Leprosy. Leprosy. If you don't understand the physical and social suffering of a leper, this passage really means nothing. It's one thing to hear, Jesus healed a guy. That's cool. But if you really understand what leprosy is and all the suffering that entails, this passage speaks to you with like levels of magnitude more in meaning. And so we're going to understand what leprosy is so we can rightly understand and apply the truth of this passage to our lives. And in order to understand leprosy best, I'll talk about some modern medical things I Googled, but I want you to turn to Leviticus 13 first, because leprosy has, biblical writings about it. Turn to Leviticus chapter 13. I'm going to point out a few things here. I'm not going to read all of chapters 13 and 14, but chapters 13 and 14 are God's given laws to Israel concerning what they called leprosy. Depending on your translation, you might read that term as defilement, but there are other translations who will say leprosy. So I'm just saying what we're talking about here as a leper in the New Testament has been commonly associated with the ailments that are being described here in Leviticus 13. And as you just kind of read through it, you're going to see a bunch of different skin diseases. You're going to see about open sores. That's sometimes they're called shiny spots in this passage. That's verses 3 and 4. I don't really know what a shiny spot looks like, but there is a type of ailment that has shiny spots. There are boils. We know what boils look like. Then there are other rashes and things like that. There's a variety of skin diseases in this passage that are described as leprosy. And what you can see in there is that there is, for each one, a criteria of what makes it unclean, whether it's white hairs, yellow hairs, whether it's the details are there. I'm not trying to explain what they mean or what disease they might be, but the idea is these people are either have a common rash, in which case it's going to fade over a number of days. There's a quarantine period all throughout this passage, where if you have one of these things, an open sore, a rash, a boil, it's really funny. It says, if you're balding, you're clean. But if you have something that's causing you to be bald underneath, like a sore, you're probably unclean. So good news for you men, when your hair falls out, you're likely still ceremonially clean. I'm looking at you, Brad. what I want you to see here is that there are various skin diseases, and for each one, there's a level of criteria of observing. There's a putting away a quarantine period, and then there's a way to determine whether you're unclean or whether you are clean. And even those who have been set aside wash themselves and then re-enter the community. What I really want to show you is what happens to those who are deemed unclean. What verse is this? I have to find it. It's verse 45 and 46. I'm going to read it for you. The leprous person who has a disease shall wear torn clothes and let the hair of his head hang loose. He shall cover his upper lip and cry out, unclean! Unclean! He shall remain unclean as long as he has the disease. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside of the camp. So, when I say leprosy, what we think of the most is what's actually modernly called Hansen's disease. And apparently, it's a disease that attacks the nervous system. It also has the skin condition, so it would be under one of these qualifications in Leviticus 13. And these people, you can look up all the things that, it's so crazy. The face on their skin thickens and becomes shiny as a product of this. I don't understand that. But they lose the feeling, so they can't feel pain. And so they'll bash their finger or their toe or scuff something, won't know it, it'll get infected. And that's why we talk about lepers as those who are losing parts of their bodies, because it's not really the leprosy, but it's all the secondary infections that they're being affected by. That's probably what the leper in our story today has. But what I'm trying to draw out is any level of uncleanliness cast people out of the camp. You have a rash, it itches, you're miserable, right? You have boils and open sores, they hurt, they ache, you're uncomfortable. But more than that, when you are declared unclean according to Old Testament law, this is ceremonial uncleanliness, you are removed from your home. You live outside the camp. You have to physically make yourself look unclean. Yeah. They shall wear torn clothes. You have to dress like you're impoverished. You have to not take care of your hair. The hair of his head shall hang loose. You have to cover your upper lip. I think that means wear a mask type of thing. We're not too far removed from having to wear masks. And it's communicating this idea, whether or not medically these things are spread by that they are unclean, they are contagious, they are something that is dirty. They have to signify that by wearing something. And more than that, you have to cry out. Someone comes close to you, unclean, unclean. You're speaking about yourself. And then, man, as long as you have the disease, you're unclean. That kind of feels guilty just to know. I mean, say I'm unclean. Even if you know you're not, you feel dirty now, don't you? I am unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. For as long as this disease may last, you read chapter 14, you read chapter 13, there are ways that disease goes away. A priest comes, they offer sacrifices, they ceremonially cleanse himself, and it's back to life. But what happens if it isn't cleared up? Many of these boils will go away. I don't know medicine, and I haven't studied what these might be, but imagine this is Hansen's disease, something that we now can cure through much medicine, but that isn't going to just come and fade. Imagine this man living outside of the city or in a quarantine part of town or outside the camp in the Old Testament in pain, or if he can't feel pain, crippled, limited, always having to be careful lest he stub his toe on a rock and then lose his toe. Maybe he is maimed or crippled, unable to do things well, living alone or with other crippled people who aren't helping as well, away from his family or her family, away from those who love you, protect you. Even if those are devoted to you, having to stay away and talk to you from here. And now we're not far removed from 2020. Where this idea of isolation you can really relate to. Who felt isolated during the COVID quarantine lockdowns? Raise your hand. It wasn't fun, was it? And how long did we go through that? Some of us less than others because we decided to do our own thing. But all of us operated in some level of isolation for a year and a year and a half, and we were miserable. Imagine decades of this. Imagine years of this. Day after day, alone. That's the picture we get as we even enter into our passage this morning. That context that I am uncomfortable. I am living alone. I am unable to truly do work for myself. I'm probably living off of handouts or what meager things I can do. I am alone. I miss my family. And I feel the guilt of being unclean. Can you imagine that misery? I don't think we really can, but we can try. We can try to understand what it's like to be isolated and alone and having to keep ourselves alone. It's one thing to feel alone in the midst of a room. It's one thing to not be making friends, but then have people around you. It's another to be cast out, to be intentionally, by law, avoided. And then imagine the stigma that comes with that. The stigma, the belief about, like, man, there. Even the belief, the Bible never teaches this, but the common belief throughout the ages has always been when people get sick. I mean, you read Job? Job, you totally did something wrong, man. You wouldn't be having this if you had sinned against God. So there's a stigma that they must have done something wrong. They're liars. They're sinners, even if that isn't true. This is misery, both physically. We can relate to physical misery. We've all had a fever. We feel terrible for a few days. But imagine that as a life. And then the social stigma of you don't even have a phone to scroll through or to call in. You are actually alone. I want you to try to relate to that right now. Because that's who our leper is. He's miserable and he's longing. He just wants to be clean. He just wants to go home. And he has discovered a newfound and singular hope. He's heard through the leper grapevine or someone who's come out to yell it to them from afar, there is one who has astonishing authority. He's healing fevers. Demons are fleeing. And can you imagine hearing that and you go, that could be me. I can be healed. I can be made clean. So we don't know how long this leper's been afflicted, all the details there, but we can imagine he has a hope to be made clean. Whether it's been 5 days or 5 years, he has heard of Jesus, the man with astonishing authority, and so he runs to Jesus. This leper, a man who's, we can imagine, is as good as dead, now knows there's one who can heal him, who can really make him alive. And so he runs to him. He goes, and I want you to see, I can't say for a fact all those imagining things I can say about this leper, but Mark, in our story, writes with enough longing, enough pleading, that it's very easy to see the desperation and the boldness of this man. Look at verse 40. You see, the leper comes. That's a big deal. Lepers, we read in Leviticus, are supposed to stay away. He breaks convention. He does something offensive. He comes to Jesus. It's not clear whether Jesus is in a town or outside of a town right here, but wherever he is, the leper approaches him, which lepers are not supposed to do. That's boldness and confidence in exactly who he is approaching. The leper implores. Your translation might say begging. Have you ever begged for something? Have you ever asked really, at least whinily, for something before? That's essentially begging. He falls on his knees, and we don't know if he's grabbing his knees or if he's that posture of, I'm begging down here. But have you ever fallen to your knees for anything besides maybe proposing? Do you ever realize you fall on your knees to propose, which kind of looks like begging? Never. It is begging. Lord, thank you that they accept our begging. But this is begging. This is desperation. This is, I'm breaking the law because I know this is the only way I might be healed. And then I want you to really hear what the leper says. If you will, you can make me clean. There's not a doubt in this man's mind that Jesus can do whatever he wants. There's not a doubt that he's not doubting ability. He's doubting willingness. He goes, I know he can, but will he? You can heal me. You're the only one, I think, who can heal me. But will you? Will you wield your astonishing authority? Will you display your power for the sake of me? What we see there is remarkable faith, really unwavering faith that Jesus is something special. Jesus is one who has the authority to do these things, and utter dependence that if his life is going to go well, he must rely on this man. And truly there, we need to step out of the story. I've said this before and many times in our small group this week, we talked about it, college students. I've talked about this in parables and in the story of Esther. But stories can do two things for us. They act as a mirror in which you see yourself, often a lot less pretty than you remember. And they act as a window that display to us a picture or a zoomed-in shot like a telescope of God and his beauty and his splendor. Today, our story, it does both. It is a mirror. And surprise, surprise, who do you think you are in this story? Call it out. It's two characters. You're the leper. That's the point. You are unclean. You were at least born into a state of utter misery, both utter physical misery and utter relational misery. Sin started essentially with patient zero. If leprosy is a disease, sin is a disease as well. And it started with our father, Adam, in the garden with Eve when they decided to disobey God's command to determine that God had not said what he said and to take of the fruit which they were commanded not to take of and then eat of it. And that plague, that disease, that leprosy of sin spread to his progeny, to his descendants. And then when you're born a sinner. And as soon as you're able, you sin because you got the disease. The spots come out and you walk according to that disease. You live your life plagued by it. And I want to show you what this misery consists of. This misery of sin, of this plague, which some people are blissfully unaware of how miserable they are. But the fact is, we are all miserable because we lack communion with God. If the camp of Israel, if God is in the middle, because he was, that's where the tabernacle was, and those who were clean could approach that, you and your uncleanliness of sin have been cast out of the camp, which means you've been cast out of the presence and the communion with God. Adam and Eve, did they stay in the garden? No, it's because they were unclean. They were sinners, and the garden was a glorious temple to walk with God, of which they were no longer qualified to approach. They're also cursed with death. It takes some 900 years for them to experience physical death, but the spiritual death happens at the end of Genesis 3. They're separated from God, relational misery, no longer walking in the garden. And then there's much physical misery in their life through the curse of sin. It's really the effects of sin. Just like the effects of leprosy is I'm going to get sores that hurt. My eyesight's going to fade. Apparently my nose is going to cave in. Or say I got boils. My boils are going to hurt. Sin has its effects in misery and the curse. If you look at the curse, women, childbearing becomes painful. For those who have children, you can attest to that. But more than that, that's not just the physical pain. It means raising a child becomes hard because they too are sinners. Who has ever gotten frustrated with a child? You don't have to be a parent to be frustrated with a child. That's because childbearing has been cursed. More than that, relationships become strained. Who has ever been angry? That's because there's enmity between men and women. And that doesn't just apply to marriage where everyone wants to be in charge. Everyone wants to be in charge of everything. You fought with your parents as children because you wanted to be in charge. You fight with your teachers because you want to be in charge. You fight with the government because you want to be in charge. You fight with each other because someone wants to be right. That's an effect of sin. And it's miserable. Conflict is miserable. That's why you get depressed. That's why you get sad. That's why... Who feels good when they're angry? Does anyone ever feel... Can someone say, I've ever felt good when I'm angry? You feel self-righteous, but do you feel good? No, you're angry. It's miserable. Your blood pressure goes up. It doesn't help you at all. And then, more than that, relationships are hard. Work is hard. Thorns and thistles exist. And whether or not you've ever walked through the woods or gardened and got a thorn and thistle, you've hit a snag in a project. You are thwarted. The bolt was stuck. That's a thorn and thistle. Your Wi-Fi goes out. You can't upload your paper. That's a thorn and thistle. We experience all of these things. These are the effects of sin. We are miserable. But the greatest misery is that first one, that relational misery. You see, leprosy, or the sin of leprosy, it attacks our senses in the same way Hansen's disease attacks our senses. It leads us to call, to not be able to feel what is actually good and evil. We end up calling evil good and calling good evil. Our senses are marred. Our sight becomes faded. We can no longer see truth. And more than that, we feel alone. You might be able to say and be confident in whatever life you're living, but at the end of the day, there is an innate emptiness in the hearts of men. There's an innate longing for more and a desire to seek their purpose. Theologians have long described it as having a God-sized hole in our hearts that we seek to fill with so many other things. But the problem is, there's nothing that can fill a God-sized hole except God himself, right? I don't want to make it too simple, but it's a simple puzzle. The triangle does not go in the circle. If there's a God-sized hole, it must have a God-sized filling. And we try to fill it with things that are all lies. And that could even be lies of ideas and systems. Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, natural law. Whatever you want, whatever ideal you want to fill is a lie that we believe as we try to fill the emptiness inside ourselves. The psalmist says it best. That reflects this truth. Who can satisfy my soul but you? If you ever strive to find satisfaction in your soul apart from God, you know you might taste a little something sweet for a minute, but at the end of the day, you're not filled. We are unclean because of our sin. The point is, you're unclean. Are you, like the leper, able to recognize that? Because that's one of the biggest problems you'll face in your life. To be like, I'm good. I'm not miserable. You try to fight the lie. I'm not miserable. I'm good. I'm going to be happy. I just got to keep pressing on. No, you're not. You are unclean, relationally miserable, and physically miserable. We have a God-sized problem that needs a God-sized answer. And the good news is, what Mark is writing about is there is one in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The Bible teaches in various levels of clarity over the course of its writing that God, out of his mere good pleasure, determined to enter into a covenant of grace to make promises to sinful, miserable men. Really, from before the foundation of the world, he determined to do this in order to deliver them out of misery. And that's brought about by their own sin and bring them back into right relationship, to bring them back into the camp, to draw close to him. Not really what's amazing, not just to be clean, but to be made holy, to enter into that holy of holies and dwell, not close to him, but with him. That's what we sang of. Is anyone worthy? He was worthy. Do you believe the world is broken? Yes, I'm miserable. Do you long to see it made new? Well, really, it's not just we long to. I know we will. Because that's what God has promised to do on behalf of his people. Do you know what shows us that there is salvation won by a Redeemer? Jesus' willingness and ability to cleanse the leper. That's how this story is a window. We're seeing a picture of the whole narrative of scriptures in this story. You are in desperate need. And once you realize that, God has provided an answer. He's not just able to do it. He's God. He is willing to do it. And that's the glory of the gospel. Not that our God is able, but our God is willing to do what it takes to draw us near to God. He made a way Romans 5 says, for while we were still weak, Christ died for the ungodly. Another way to say that, he died for those who were unclean in order that they might be reconciled to God. And our story shows us this. It gives us a window into the heart and purpose of God. I want you to look at verse 41, and this is where you're going to notice a difference that I'll hope to explain in a moment. My translation, the NIV, says, Jesus was indignant. He reached out his hand. He touched this man. I am willing. Be clean. Many of your translations are going to say, Jesus, being moved with pity, reached out his hand and do that. And obviously, there's nothing close between indignant or angry and compassionate. Those are not, oh yeah, they decided to translate this word. No, those are two different words. They're not closely related at all. So I have to explain something to you. There's a discipline. There's something called textual criticism, which you don't need to remember that word. But the reality is we have some 5,000 original Greek manuscripts that have been written throughout the centuries that we have collected into one Greek manuscript where we've translated the Bible into English. Tracking with that? Not surprised that God did not speak in English? Okay, good. So that sounds pretty alarming. That there are differences in these Greek manuscripts. Does that alarm anyone? Okay, I'm glad. It shouldn't be, because of all those mistakes, which there's somewhere like almost a half a million of them, 70% of them are spelling errors. Ever made a mistake in spelling? I stink at spelling. Without the squiggle line in Microsoft Word or whatever, I would never spell anything correctly. Some of these differences are the difference between spelling the name John, J-O-N, and J-O-H-N. They're negligible. It's just a typo or a difference in spelling. However, there are variants that are distinct differences, like compassion and anger, right? That's not a spelling issue. Well, I'll tell you. In Greek, that's not a spelling issue. One of the words is significantly longer than the other. It's not a close word together. Mark 1:41 is a well-known textual variant issue where there are differences in the Greek manuscripts. And unlike some that's like, okay, yeah, we have like 10 documents from super long time ago that say this, and then 300 years later they added something. It's pretty clear to see someone added something there. This is one of those that has a lot of mixed tradition. But I want to submit to you, whatever way you decide is the original text, what we see about God is consistent with the narrative. I'm going to show you that this is two sides of the same coin that shows us a mighty and loving God. If you read Jesus as being moved with compassion, you see that Jesus is loving and merciful and demonstrates the truth that he speaks plainly a little bit later in Mark 2:17. I came for those, I did not come for those who are well. I came for those who have a need of a physician. I came for the sick, not the healthy. Literally, we see that in this passage. He comes and heals the sick because he knows they need saved. These are the ones he came to save. And when we rightly see ourselves in the mirror, we go, wow, a God willing to come close, to touch me. You know what he touches this leper? An act of great compassion. He desires mercy. He desires to cleanse. He is both willing and able to. And we can apply from here. He will cleanse you from all unrighteousness, sinner, if you would go to him. And that's the gospel, right? Jesus says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden. Don't get yourself right before you go to God. Go to God and be made right. Be made clean. He is able and he invites you to come. It's for the reason he came, because you are unclean, so that he might make you clean. And it's exactly these types of truths that he comes to teach and is preaching in these cities, that the prophets spoke of old, that Jesus interpreted to the people on the road to Emmaus and to the disciples after his resurrection, and that the apostles continue to teach as inspired by his Spirit. These are the truths that Jesus teaches. And that we continue to teach that Jesus will save you if you would call on his name in order to be saved. By grace, you can experience the joy and flourishing of life by Jesus' cleansing power. But we also get to the same conclusion if we read that Jesus was indignant or angry. You just have to understand what he's indignant or angry at. Because clearly, he's not angry at the leper. I don't say, I'm angry at you. Now I'm healing you. I'm mad, but you get exactly what you want. That doesn't make logical sense at all, right? Right. So what is he angry at? I am persuaded, yes, he's angry at the disease, which might sound weird. He's angry at that. He's angry at the effects and misery that keep people apart from him, that cause those whom he loves to suffer, and even that are leading them to their destruction and death. What's the end of leprosy? Death. What's the end of your sin? Death. Eternal death. Jesus describes it as a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. And not just because, oh, I'm going to be tortured. That would suck. But no. No, you're going to be apart from God. That emptiness, that loneliness will last forever because you are not with who you were designed to be with. But Mark has pictured Jesus. We're still in chapter 1, by the way. But Mark has intentionally pictured Jesus as a mighty warrior coming to fight an enemy. He's painted as a cosmic battle. We see that in the temptation of Jesus a few verses earlier, where he goes and he does what we cannot withstand temptation. And why does he do that? Because the claims of sin and death will not have a hold on him. He will defeat the temptation of sin and put death to death. He is opposed to them and he will have the victory. We also see this in the demon's words. He goes, I know who you are, Jesus, the Holy One of God. A title that's not just saying, oh, he's special, but oh no, he's a mighty warrior coming to vanquish the enemies of God and his people. That's exactly what we see Jesus do. Jesus doesn't say, it is finished, for no reason. He says, it is finished, because Paul later quotes a song, because death was crushed to death. Sin is put in the grave. We read Revelations. Sin and death, these personified ideas of the curse, are going to be cast down as well. Satan the dragon, sin and death, those enemies that plague mankind, are going to be destroyed. They will be no more. He is a mighty conquering king. It's with him we're more than conquerors, but that's only because he conquers. Jesus is a mighty warrior who is angry at evil. Not just because it's evil. There isn't this dichotomy where he's like, oh, my enemy. No, he's saying, my people are suffering. And out of my anger for their suffering, because I love them so much, I will do exactly what is needed. And what's needed is for that suffering to be taken upon himself. That's why the Old Testament speaks, the prophet Isaiah, that he bears our transgression. That's why he is hung on a tree for us. That's why we can say, by his wounds we are healed, because he bears the suffering that you might bear the blessing that only he earned. That's the gospel. His life given for you. The life he earned freely granted to you. You are unclean. But whether you want to say Jesus is merciful and compassionate and willing to cleanse you, or he hates the effects of sin and desires you to be set free from it, both of those are the gospel. Two sides of the coins, head and tail, but you can take it to the bank and cash it in because they are according to God's consistent and regular promises of the scripture. This takes us to our third point. Jesus's charge, his command, in your response. And honestly, these verses, 43 through 45, still a little confusing to me. I think they'll become more clear as we continue throughout Mark and this next segment and the things that are going on. But we see that the leper comes, Jesus saves him. We see the gospel there. I've labored to try to show you the gospel there, at least. So we see the leper's faith to be greatly commended, But then the leper does exactly the opposite of what Jesus says. Right? Do y'all see that the leper disobeys Jesus? He says, don't talk. And it says, the guy went and talked. I can't commend that. I can totally understand that. If you told me, you see how the leprosy goes away immediately? Something great happens to me, I'm going to want to go talk as well. The problem is, we can't make the application. Like, to say, you can't help but say what Jesus has done to you, go and share the gospel, I think that's true, but I think that's a very bad application of this text. That is true, hear that. You should share the gospel, you should speak of Jesus, but there are other passages that teach us that clearly. Instead, we see that disobedience to Jesus' command hinders his ministry, which is something hard to wrestle with, because I believe, and you do too, in a God of providence who ordains and permits and designs all things to come to pass. So how is he hindered by something he ordained? Big question. We'll wrestle with that later. But I want you to see the effects of the disobedience of the leper. Jesus is hindered from entering into towns and to do what he came here to do, which we see in earlier in verse 38. He goes, let us go somewhere else to the nearby villages so I can preach there also. And then verse 45, he can no longer go into those villages and do what he came to do, to proclaim the gospel, which is, I think it's in 1:15. He says, the time has come. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel of God. Jesus is ultimately not hindered. He fulfills his plan. He equips his people. The gospel has spread all the way here to Moorhead, Kentucky, from Galilee and Jerusalem. But his effect was hindered. And what I want to apply that to in our lives is Jesus gives us very clear commands, right? You read the Bible, thou shalt not do this, do not do this, instead do this, put to death the passions of the flesh, live and walk according to the Spirit. To disobey Jesus' clear charge, does anyone have a doubt in their mind the leper did not understand that Jesus said, don't tell this to anyone? Is there a doubt in your mind? No. There's not a doubt in my mind that we hear and understand the commands of the Lord, yet we choose to do otherwise. That is sin. That is disobedience. And I want to show you that that, in one sense, hinders God's design for your life. Here's an example. I'm a pastor of this church, an under-shepherd of the great shepherd, and I've been given clear tasks, right? I'm supposed to teach sound doctrine and refute false doctrine. What happens when I don't do that? Well, hopefully we have really good members. You all fire me and cast me out from this role and appoint another qualified man. But throughout the history of the world, what a leader does, the people follow. There are great examples. But if I were to start teaching false doctrine, the decades-long approach is this becomes a church that believes a false gospel. Go into an American church and you'll see this to be true. It hinders God's design. This church fails because I fail to obey. Say I even obey it. I preach sound doctrine, but I don't do so with patience and gentleness. Do you know what happens? Many who ought to be protected are wounded. Not obeying God's command hinders his design and purposes. We see this in 1 Peter. Husbands, if you fail to live in an understanding way, what happens? Your prayers are, hear that word, hindered. Wives, when you don't live with your husbands in an understanding, no, the opposite word. If you don't submit to your husbands as to the Lord, do you know what's hindered? Your witness. They're not going to be one. They're not going to see the quiet spirit of your mother, Sarah. And the harsh and unbelieving will not be one to the beauty of the gospel by your good conduct. Hindrance for disobedience. All believers, when you sinned, your witness is hindered. You're supposed to be, your salt loses its saltiness. It's useless. Your light gets hidden under a bushel. And we all know, hide my light under a bushel? No, I'm going to let it shine. Thank you for that. I'm going to let it shine. And from this passage, I just want to apply that to our lives. Your obedience matters. Jesus cleanses you not just for your own goodness, but for his great glory as seen by your ability and desire to walk according to his good and gracious commands. So yes, spread the gospel. Proclaim about Jesus. There is no limitations on that. There is no application of Jesus saying, shh, to you anymore, believer. But there is a great necessity for you to listen, to hear, and to repent when you disobey Jesus' commands. All right, so we have seen by the leper that we are unclean, but there's a great hope for the unclean, because Jesus is willing and able to cleanse us from all unrighteousness, and being cleansed ought to be met with obedience with great joy.